and longest whenever one of his dwarfs suffered a fall or took a blow, his whole vast body shaking like suet in an earthquake. His guest waited to see how Yerkaz Zoyonzek responded before joining in. The supreme commander appeared so frail that Tyrion was afraid laughing might kill him. When Penny's helm was struck off and flew into the lap of a sour-faced Yunkishman in a striped green and gold toga, Yerkaz cackled like a chicken. When said lord reached inside the helm and drew out a large purple melon, dribbling pulp, he wheezed until his face turned the same color as the fruit. He turned to his host and whispered something that made their master chortle and lick his lips, though there was a hint of anger in those slitted yellow eyes, it seemed to Tyrion. Afterward, the dwarfs stripped off their wooden armor and the sweat-soaked clothing beneath, and changed into the fresh yellow tunics that had been provided them for serving. Tyrion was given a flagon of purple wine, Penny a flagon of water. They moved about the tent, filling cups, their slippered feet whispering over thick carpets. It was harder work than it appeared. Before long, his legs were cramping badly, and one of the cuts on his back had begun to bleed again, the red seeping through the yellow linen of his tunic. Tyrion bit his tongue and kept on pouring. Most of the guests paid them no more mind than they did the other slaves, but one Yunkishman declared drunkenly that Yezin should make the two dwarfs fuck, and another demanded to know how Tyrion had lost his nose. "I shoved it up your wife's cunt, and she bit it off," he almost replied, but the storm had persuaded him that he did not want to die as yet, so instead he said, "It was cut off to punish me for insolence, lord." Then a lord in a blue tokar, fringed with tiger's eyes, recalled that Tyrion had boasted of his skill at Syvas, on the auction block. "Let us put him to the test," he said. A table and set of pieces was duly produced. A scant few moments later, the red-faced lord shoved the table over in fury, scattering the pieces across the carpets to the sound of Yunkish laughter.
"You should have let him win," Penny whispered.
Brown Ben Plum lifted the fallen table, smiling.
"Try me next, dwarf. When I was younger, the second sons took contract with Volantis. I learned the game there."
"I'm only a slave. My noble master decides when and who I play."
Tyrion turned to Yezin.
"Master?"
The Yellow Lord seemed amused by the notion.
"What stakes do you propose, Captain?"
"If I win, give the slave to me," said Plum.
"No," Yezanzo Kaga said.
"But if you can defeat my dwarf, you may have the price I paid for him in gold."
"Done," the sailsword said. The scattered pieces were picked up off the carpet, and they sat down to play. Tyrion won the first game. Plum took the second, for double the stakes. As they set up for their third contest, the dwarf studied his opponent. Bronze-skinned, his cheeks and jaw covered by a close-cropped, bristly beard of grey and white, his face creased by a thousand wrinkles and a few old scars. Plum had an amiable look to him, especially when he smiled.
"The faithful retainer," Tyrion decided.
"Every man's favourite nuncle, full of chuckles and old sayings and rough-spun wisdom."
It was all sham. Those smiles never touched Plum's eyes, where greed hid behind a veil of caution.
"Hungry, but wary, this one."
The sailsword was nearly as bad a player as the Yunkish lord had been, but his play was stolid and tenacious, rather than bold. His opening arrays were different every time, yet all the same, conservative, defensive, passive. "He does not play to win," Tyrion realized.
"He plays so as not to lose."
It worked in the second game, when the little man overreached himself with an unsound assault. It did not work in the third game, nor the fourth, nor the fifth, which proved to be their last. Near the end of that final contest, with his fortress in ruins, his dragon dead, elephants before him, and heavy horse circling round his rear, Plum looked up smiling and said, "Yellow wins again. Death in four." "Three?" Tyrion tapped his dragon. "I was lucky. Perhaps you should give my head a good rub before our next game, Captain. Some of that luck might rub off on your fingers." "You will still lose, but you might give me a better game." Grinning, he pushed back from the Syvas table, picked up his wine flagon, and returned to pouring with Yezen Zokagas, considerably richer, and Brown Ben Plum, considerably impoverished. His gargantuan master had slipped off into drunken sleep during the third game, his goblet slipping from his yellowed fingers to spill its contents on the carpet, but perhaps he would be pleased when he awakened. When the Supreme Commander, Yerkes Zoyunsek, departed, supported by a pair of burly slaves, that seemed to be a general signal for the other guests to take their leaves as well. After the tent had emptied out, Nurse reappeared to tell the servers that they might make their own feast from the leavings. "Eat quickly. All this must be clean again before you sleep." Tyrion was on his knees, his legs aching and his bloody back screaming with pain, trying to scrub out the stain that the noble Yezan's spilled wine had left upon the noble Yezan's carpet, when the overseer tapped his cheek gently with the end of his whip. "Yellow, you have done well, you and your wife." "She's not my wife." "Your whore, then. On your feet, both of you." Tyrion rose unsteadily, one leg trembling beneath him. His thighs were knots, so cramped that Penny had to lend him a hand to pull him to his feet. "What have we done?" "Much and more," said the overseer. "Nurse said you would be rewarded if you pleased your father, did he not? Though the noble Yezan is loath to lose his little treasures, as you have seen, Yerkes Zoyunsek persuaded him that it would be selfish to keep such droll antics to himself. Rejoice! To celebrate the signing of the peace, you shall have the honour of jousting in the great pit of Dasnek. Thousands will come see you, tens of thousands, and oh, how we shall laugh!" Jaime. Raven Tree Hall was old. Moss grew thick between its ancient stones, spider webbing up its walls like the veins in a crone's legs. Two huge towers flanked the castle's main gate, and smaller ones defended every angle of its walls. All were square. Drum towers and half-moons held up better against catapults, since thrown stones were more apt to deflect off a curved wall. But Raventree predated that particular bit of builder's wisdom. The castle dominated the broad, fertile valley that maps and men alike called Blackwood Vale. A vale it was, beyond a doubt, but no wood had grown there for several thousand years, be it black or brown or green. Once, yes, but axes had long since cleared the trees away. Homes and mills and holdfasts had risen where once the oaks stood tall. The ground was bare and muddy, and dotted here and there with drifts of melting snow. Inside the castle walls, however, a bit of the forest still remained. House Blackwood kept the old gods, and worshipped as the first men had in the days before the Andals had come to Westeros. Some of the trees in their godswood were said to be as old as Raven Tree's square towers, especially the Heart Tree, a weirwood of colossal size, whose upper branches could be seen from leagues away, like bony fingers scratching at the sky. As Jaime Lannister and his escort wound through the rolling hills into the vale, little remained of the fields and farms and orchards that had once surrounded Raventree. Only mud and ashes, and here and there the blackened shells of homes and mills. Weeds and thorns and nettles grew in that wasteland, but nothing that could be called a crop. Everywhere Jamie looked, he saw his father's hand, even in the bones they sometimes glimpsed beside the road. Most were sheep bones, but there were horses, too, and cattle, and now and again a human skull, or a headless skeleton with weeds poking up to its ribcage. No great hosts encircled Raventree, as Riveron had been encircled. This siege was a more intimate affair, the latest step in a dance that went back many centuries. At best, Jones Bracken had 500 men about the castle. Jamie saw no siege towers, no battering rams, no catapults. Bracken did not mean to break the gates of Raventree, nor storm its high, thick walls. With no prospect of relief in sight, he was content to starve his rival out. No doubt there had been sorties and skirmishes at the start of the siege, and arrows flying back and forth. Half a year into it, everyone was too tired for such nonsense. Boredom and routine had taken over, the enemies of discipline. Past time this was ended, thought Jamie Lannister. With Riveron now safely in Lannister hands, Raventree was the remnant of the young wolf's short-lived kingdom. Once it yielded, his work along the Trident would be done, and he would be free to return to King's Landing. "To the king," he told himself, but another part of him whispered, "to Cersei." He would have to face her, he supposed, assuming the High Septon had not put her to death by the time he got back to the city. "Come at once," she had written in the letter she had pecked Byrne at Riverine. "Help me, save me. I need you now as I have never needed you before. I love you, I love you, I love you. Come at once." Her need was real enough. Jamie did not doubt. As for the rest, she's been fucking Lancel and Osmond Kettleblack and Moonboy, for all I know. Even if he had gone back, he could not hope to save her. She was guilty of every treason laid against her, and he was short a sword hand. When the column came trotting from the fields, the sentries stared at them with more curiosity than fear. No one sounded the alarm, which suited Jamie well enough. Lord Bracken's pavilion did not prove difficult to find. It was the largest in the camp and the best sited. Sitting atop a low rise beside a stream, it commanded a clear view of two of Raventree's gates. The tent was brown, like the standard flapping from its center pole, where the red stallion of House Bracken reared upon its gold escutcheon. Jamie gave the order to dismount, and told his men they might mingle if they liked. "Not you two," he said to his banner-bearers. "Stay close. This will not keep me long." Jamie vaulted down off honor and strode to Bracken's tent, his sword rattling in its scabbard. The guards outside the tent flap exchanged an anxious look at his approach. "My lord," said one, "shall we announce you?" "I'll announce myself." Jamie pushed aside the flap with his golden hand and ducked inside. They were well and truly at it when he entered, so intent on their rutting that neither took any note of his arrival. The woman had her eyes closed. Her hands clutched the coarse brown hair on Bracken's back. She gasped every time that he drove into her. His lordship's head was buried in her breasts, his hands locked around her hips. Jamie cleared his throat. "Lord Jonas!" The woman's eyes flew open, and she gave a startled shriek. Jonas Bracken rolled off her, grabbed for his scabbard, and came up with naked steel in hand, cursing. "Seven bloody hells!" he started. "Who dares?" Then he saw Jamie's white cloak and golden breastplate. his sword point dropped.
"Lannister!"
"I'm sorry to disturb you at your pleasure, my lord," said Jamie, with a half-smile, "but I am in some haste. May we talk?"
"Talk, eh?"
Lord Jonas sheathed his sword. He was not quite so tall as Jamie, but he was heavier, with thick shoulders and arms that would have made a blacksmith envious. Brown stubble covered his cheeks and chin. His eyes were brown as well, the anger in them poorly hidden.
"You took me unawares, my lord. I was not told of your coming, and I seem to have prevented yours."
Jamie smiled at the woman in his bed. She had one hand over her left breast and the other between her legs, which left her right breast exposed. Her nipples were darker than Cersei's and thrice the size. When she felt Jamie's gaze, she covered her right nipple, but that revealed her mound. "Are all camp followers so modest?" he wondered aloud. "If a man wants to sell his turnips, he needs to set them out."
"You've been looking at my turnips since you came in, sir."
The woman found the blanket and pulled it up high enough to cover herself to the waist, then raised one hand to push her hair back from her eyes.
"And they're not for sale, neither."
Jamie gave a shrug. "My apologies if I mistook you for something you're not. My little brother has known 100 whores, I'm sure. But I've only ever bedded one. She's a prize of war." Bracken retrieved his breeches from the floor and shook them out. "She belonged to one of Blackwood's sworn swords, till I split his head in two. Put your hands down, woman. My lord of Lannister wants a proper look at those teats." Jamie ignored that. "You are putting those breeches on backwards, my lord," he told Bracken. As Jonas cursed, the woman slipped off the bed to snatch up her scattered clothing, her fingers fluttering nervously between her breasts and cleft, as she bent and turned and reached. Her efforts to conceal herself were oddly provocative, far more so than if she'd simply gone about the business naked. "Do you have a name, woman?" he asked her.
"My mother named me Hildy, sir."
She pulled a soiled shift down over her head and shook her hair out. Her face was almost as dirty as her feet, and she had enough hair between her legs to pass for Bracken's sister. But there was something appealing about her all the same. That pug nose, her shaggy mane of hair, or the way she did a little curtsy after she had stepped into her skirt.
"Have you seen my other shoe, milord?"
The question seemed to vex Lord Bracken.
"Am I a bloody handmaid to fetch your shoes? Go barefoot if you must. Just go."
"Does that mean my lord won't be taking me home with him to pray with his little wife?"
Laughing, Hilda gave Jamie a brazen look.
"Do you have a little wife, sir?"
"No, I have a sister."
"What colour is my cloak?"
"White," she said. "But your hand is solid gold. I like that in a man. And what is it you like in a woman, my lord?"
"Innocence."
"In a woman," I said, "not a daughter."
He thought of Marcella. "I will need to tell her, too. The Dornishman might not like that. Dorian Martell had betrothed her to his son, in the belief that she was Robert's blood." "Nuts and tangles," Jamie thought, wishing he could cut through all of it with one swift stroke of his sword. "I have sworn a vow," he told Hildy warily.
"No turnips for you, then,"
the girl said saucily.
"Get out!"
Lord Jonas roared at her. She did, but as she slipped past Jamie, clutching one shoe and a pile of her clothes, she reached down and gave his cock a squeeze through his breeches.
"Hildy,"
she reminded him, before she darted, half-clothed from the tent.
"Hildy," Jamie mused. "And how fares your lady wife?"
he asked Lord Jonas, when the girl was gone.
"How would I know? Ask her Septon. When your father burned our castle, she decided the gods were punishing us. Now all she does is pray.
Jonas had finally gotten his breeches turned the right way round and was lacing them up the front.
What brings you here, my lord? The Blackfish? We heard how he escaped.
Did you?
Jamie settled on a camp stool. From the man himself, perchance?
Sir Brendan knows better than to come running to me. I am fond of the man, I won't deny that. That won't stop me clapping him in chains if he shows his face near me, or mine. He knows I've bent the knee. He should have done the same, but he always was a stubborn one. His brother could have told you that.
Titus Blackwood has not bent the knee, Jamie pointed out. Might the Blackfish seek refuge at Raventree?
He may seek it, but to find it he'll need to get past my siege lines, and last I heard he hadn't grown wings. Titus will be needing refuge himself before much longer. They're down to rats and roots in there. He'll yield before the next full moon. He'll yield before the sun goes down. I mean to offer him terms and accept him back into the king's peace.
I see.
Lord Jonas shrugged into a brown woolen tunic with a red stallion of bracken embroidered on the front.
Will my lord take a horn of ale?
No, but don't go dry on my account.
Bracken filled a horn for himself, drank half of it, and wiped his mouth.
You spoke of terms. What sort of terms?
The usual sort, Lord Blackwood, shall be required to confess his treason and abjure his allegiance to the Starks and Tullys.
He will swear solemnly before gods and men to henceforth remain a leal vassal of Harrenhal and the Iron Throne, and I will give him pardon in the king's name. We will take a pot or two of gold, of course, the price of rebellion. I'll claim a hostage as well, to ensure that Raventree does not rise again.
His daughter, suggested Bracken. Blackwood has 6 sons, but only 1 daughter. He dotes on her. A snot-nosed little creature couldn't be more than 7.
Young, but she might serve.
Lord Jonas drained the last of his ale and tossed the horn aside.
What of the lands and castles we were promised?
What lands were these?
The east bank of the Widow's Wash, from Crossbow Ridge to Rutting Meadow, and all the islands in the stream, Grindcorn Mill and Lord's Mill, the ruins of Muddy Hall, the Ravishment, Battle Valley, Old Forge, the villages of Buckle, Black Buckle, Cairns, and Claypool, and the market town at Mudgrave, Waspwood, Logan's Wood, Greenhill, and Barber's Teats. Mrs. Teats, the Blackwoods call them, but they were Barber's first. Honey Tree and all the hives. Here, I've marked them out, if my lord would like a look.
He rooted about on the table and produced a parchment map. Jamie took it with his good hand, but he had to use the gold to open it and hold it flat.
"This is a deal of land," he observed. "You will be increasing your domains by a quarter."
Bracken's mouth set stubbornly.
"All these lands belonged to Stonehenge once. The Blackwoods stole them from us."
"What about this village here, between the Teats?" Jamie tapped the map with a gilded knuckle.
"Pennytree, that was ours once too, but it's been a royal fief for 100 years.
Leave that out. We ask only for the land stolen by the Blackwoods.
Your lord father promised to restore them to us if we would subdue Lord Titus for him.
Yet as I was riding up, I saw Tully banners flying from the castle walls, and the direwolf of Stark as well.
That would seem to suggest that Lord Titus has not been subdued. We've driven him and his from the field and penned them up inside Raventree. Give me sufficient men to storm his walls, my lord, and I will subdue the whole lot of them to their graves.
If I gave you sufficient men, they would be doing the subduing, not you, in which case I should reward myself. Jamie let the map roll up again. I'll keep this, if I might. The map is yours. The lands are ours. It's said that a Lannister always pays his debts. We fought for you. Not half as long as you fought against us. The king has pardoned us for that. I lost my nephew to your swords, and my natural son. Your mountain stole my harvest and burned everything he could not carry off. He put my castle to the torch and raped one of my daughters. I will have recompense. The mountain's dead, as is my father, Jamie told him, and some might say your head was recompense enough. You did declare for Stark, and kept faith with him, until Lord Walder killed him, murdered him, and a dozen good men of my own blood. Lord Jonas turned his head and spat. I kept faith with the young wolf, as I'll keep faith with you, so long as you treat me fair. I bent the knee because I saw no sense in dying for the dead, nor shedding Bracken blood in a lost cause. A prudent man, though some might say that Lord Blackwood has been more honourable. You'll get your lands, some of them at least, since you partly subdued the Blackwoods. That seemed to satisfy Lord Jonas. We will be content with whatever portion my lord thinks fair. If I may offer you some counsel, though, it does not serve to be too gentle with these Blackwoods. Treachery runs in their blood. Before the Andals came to Westeros, House Bracken ruled this river. We were kings, and the Blackwoods were our vassals. But they betrayed us and usurped the crown. Every Blackwood is born a turncloak. You would do well to remember that when you are making terms. Oh, I shall, Jamie promised. When he rode from Bracken's siege camp to the gates of Raventree, Peck went before him with a peace banner. Before they reached the castle, 20 pairs of eyes were watching them from the gatehouse ramparts. He drew Honor to a halt at the edge of the moat, a deep trench lined with stone, its green waters choked by scum. Jamie was about to command Sir Kenneth to sound the horn of Herrick when the drawbridge began to descend. Lord Titus Blackwood met him in the outer ward, mounted on a destrier as gaunt as himself. Very tall and very thin, the Lord of Raventree had a hook nose, long hair, and a ragged salt-and-pepper beard that showed more salt than pepper. In silver inlay on the breastplate of his burnished scarlet armour was a white tree bare and dead, surrounded by a flock of onyx ravens taking flight. A cloak of raven feathers fluttered from his shoulders. "Lord Titus," Jamie said. "Sir, thank you for allowing me to enter. I will not say that you are welcome, nor will I deny that I have hoped that you might come. You are here for my sword. I am here to make an end of this. Your men have fought valiantly, but your war is lost. Are you prepared to yield? To the king, not to Jonas Bracken." "I understand." Blackwood hesitated a moment. "Is it your wish that I dismount and kneel before you here now?" 100 eyes were looking on. "The wind is cold and the yard is muddy," said Jamie. "You can do your kneeling on the carpet in your solar, once we've agreed on terms." "That is chivalrous of you," said Lord Titus. "Come, sir. My hall might lack for food, but never for courtesy." Blackwood's solar was on the second floor of a cavernous timber keep. There was a fire burning in the hearth when they entered. The room was large and airy, with great beams of dark oak supporting the high ceiling. Woolen tapestries covered the walls,
and a pair of wide lattice-work doors looked out upon the godswood. Through their thick, diamond-shaped panes of yellow glass, Jamie glimpsed the gnarled limbs of the tree from which the castle took its name. It was a weirwood, ancient and colossal, 10 times the size of the one in the stone garden at Castley Rock. This tree was bare and dead, though.
"The bracken's poisoned it," said his host. "For 1,000 years, not shown a leaf. In 1,000, it will have turned to stone, the maesters say. Weirwoods never rot."
"And the ravens?" asked Jamie. "Where are they?"
"They come at dusk and roost all night. Hundreds of them. They cover the tree like black leaves, every limb and every branch. They have been coming for 1,000s of years. How or why, no man can say. Yet the tree draws them every night."
Blackwood settled in a high-backed chair.
"For honour's sake, I must ask about my liege lord.
Sir Edmure is on his way to Castley Rock as my captive. His wife will remain at the Twins until their child is born. Then she and the babe will join him. So long as he does not attempt escape or plot rebellion, Edmure will live a long life.
Long and bitter. A life without honour. Until his dying day, men will say he was afraid to fight."
Unjustly, Jamie thought. It was his child he feared for. He knew whose son I am better than mine own aunt.
The choice was his. His uncle would have made us bleed. We agree on that much.
Blackwood's voice gave nothing away.
What have you done with Sir Brynden, if I may ask?
I offered to let him take the black. Instead, he fled.
Jamie smiled. Do you have him here, perchance?
No.
Would you tell me, if you did?
It was Titus Blackwood's turn to smile. Jamie brought his hands together, the gold fingers inside the fleshy ones.
Perhaps it is time we talked of terms. Is this where I get down on my knees?
If it please you.
Or we can say you did.
Lord Blackwood remained seated. They soon reached agreement on the major points. Confession, fealty, pardon, a certain sum of gold and silver to be paid.
What lands will you require? Lord Titus asked.
When Jamie handed him the map, he took one look and chuckled.
To be sure, the Turncloak must be given his reward.
Yes, but a smaller one than he imagines, for a smaller service. Which of these lands will you consent to part with?
Lord Titus considered for a moment. Woodhedge, Crossbow Ridge, and Buckle.
A ruin, a ridge, and a few hovels.
Oh, come, my lord, you must suffer for your treason. He will want one of the mills, at least.
Mills were a valuable source of tax. The lord received a tenth of all the grain they ground.
Lord's mill, then. Grind corn is ours.
And another village. Cairns?
I have 4 bears buried beneath the rocks of Cairns.
He looked at the map again.
Give him Honey Tree and its hives. All that sweet will make him fat and rot his teeth.
Done, then. But for one last thing.
A hostage?
Yes, my lord. You have a daughter, I believe.
Bethany, Lord Titus looked stricken. I also have 2 brothers and a sister, a pair of widowed aunts, nieces, nephews, cousins. I thought you might consent.
It must be a child of your blood.
Bethany is only 8. A gentle girl, full of laughter. She has never been more than a day's ride from my hall.
Why not let her see King's Landing? His Grace is almost of an age with her. He would be pleased to have another friend.
One he can hang, if the friend's father should displease him?
Asked Lord Titus.
I have 4 sons. Would you consider one of them instead? Ben is 12 and thirsty for adventure. He could squire for you, if it please my lord.
I have more squires than I know what to do with.
Every time I take a piss, they fight for the right to hold my cock. And you have 6 sons, my lord, not 4. Once, Robert was my youngest, and never strong. He died 9 days ago of a looseness of the bowels. Lucas was murdered at the Red Wedding. Walter Frey's 4th wife was a Blackwood, but kinship counts for no more than guest right at the twins. I should like to bury Lucas beneath the tree, but the Freys have not yet seen fit to return his bones to me.
I'll see that they do.
Was Lucas your eldest son? My 2nd. Brynden is my eldest, and my heir. Next comes Huster, a bookish boy, I fear.
They have books in King's Landing, too. I recall my little brother reading them from time to time. Perhaps your son would like to look at them. I will accept Huster as our hostage. Blackwood's relief was palpable.
Thank you, my lord.
He hesitated a moment.
If I may be so bold, you would do well to require a hostage from Lord Jonas, too. One of his daughters. For all his rutting, he has not proved man enough to father sons.
He had a bastard son killed in the war.
Did he? Harry was a bastard, true enough, but whether Jonas sired him is a thornier question. A fair-haired boy he was, and comely. Jonas is neither.
Lord Titus got to his feet.
Will you do me the honour of taking supper with me?
Some other time, my lord. The castle was starving. No good would be served by Jamie stealing food from their mouths. I cannot linger. Riveron awaits.
Riveron? Or King's Landing?
Both.
Lord Titus did not attempt to dissuade him. Huster can be ready to depart within the hour.
He was. The boy met Jamie by the stables, with a bedroll slung over one shoulder and a bundle of scrolls beneath his arm. He could not have been any older than 16, yet he was even taller than his father, almost 7 feet of legs and shins and elbows, a gangling, gawky boy with a cowlick.
Lord Commander, I'm your hostage, Huster. Huss, they call me.
He grinned. Does he think this is a lark?
Pray, who are they?
My friends, my brothers.
I am not your friend, and I am not your brother.
That cleaned the grin off the boy's face. Jamie turned to Lord Titus.
My lord, let there be no misunderstanding here. Lord Beric Dondarrion, Thoros of Myr, Sandor Clegane, Brynden Tully, this woman Stoneheart, all these are outlaws and rebels, enemies to the king and all his leal subjects. If I should learn that you or yours are hiding them, protecting them, or assisting them in any way, I will not hesitate to send you your son's head. I hope you understand that. Understand this as well. I am not Ryman Frey.
No. All trace of warmth had left Lord Blackwood's mouth.
I know who I'm dealing with. King Slayer.
Good. Jamie mounted and wheeled on her toward the gate.
I wish you a good harvest and the joy of the king's peace.
He did not ride far. Lord Jonas Bracken was waiting for him outside Raventree, just beyond the range of a good crossbow. He was mounted on an armoured destrier, and had donned his plate and mail, and a grey steel great helm with a horsehair crest.
"I saw them pull the direwolf banner down," he said, when Jamie reached him.
"Is it done?"
"Done and done. Go home and plant your fields."
Lord Bracken raised his visor.
"I trust I have more fields to plant than when you went into that castle. Buckle, wood hedge, honey tree, and all its hives."
He was forgetting one.
"Oh, and Crossbow Ridge." "A mill," said Bracken. "I must have a mill. Lord's mill."
Lord Jonas snorted.
"Aye, that will serve.
for no. He pointed at Hoster Blackwood, riding back with Peck. Is that what he gave you for a hostage? You were cousin, sir. A weakling, this one. Water for blood. Never mind how tall he is. Any one of my girls could snap him like a rotten twig.
How many daughters do you have, my lord? Jamie asked him.
5, 2 by my first wife, and 3 by my third.
Too late, he seemed to realize that he might have said too much.
Send one of them to court. She will have the privilege of attending the Queen Regent.
Bracken's face grew dark as he realized the import of those words.
Is this how you repay the friendship of Stonehenge?
It's a great honour to wait upon the Queen, Jamie reminded his lordship.
You might want to impress that honour. We'll look for the girl before the year is out.
He did not wait for Lord Bracken to reply, but touched Honour lightly with his golden spurs and trotted off. His men formed up and followed, banners streaming. Castle and camp were soon lost behind them, obscured by the dust of their hooves. Neither outlaws nor wolves had troubled them on their way to Raventree, so Jamie decided to return by a different route. If the guards were good, he might stumble on the Blackfish or lure Beric Dondarrion into an unwise attack. They were following the Widow's Wash when they ran out of day. Jamie called his hostage forward and asked him where to find the nearest ford, and the boy led them there. As the column splashed across the shallow waters, the sun was setting behind a pair of grassy hills.
"The teats," said Hoster Blackwood.
Jamie recalled Lord Bracken's map. "There's a village between those hills."
"Pennytree," the lad confirmed.
"We'll camp there for the night." If there were villages about, they might have knowledge of Sir Brynden or the outlaws.
"Lord Jonas made some remark about whose teats they were," he recalled to the Blackwood boy as they rode toward the darkening hills and the last light of the day. "The Brackens call them by one name, and the Blackwoods by another."
"Aye, my lord. For 100 years or so before that, they were the mother's teats, or just the teats. There are 2 of them, and it was thought that they resembled..."
"I can see what they resemble,"
Jamie found himself thinking back on the woman in the tent, and the way she tried to hide her large, dark nipples.
"What changed 100 years ago?"
"Aegon, the unworthy, took Barbara Bracken as his mistress," the bookish boy replied. "She was a very buxom wench, they say, and one day when the king was visiting at the Stonehenge, he went out hunting, and saw the teats, and—"
"Name them for his mistress?"
Aegon the Fourth had died long before Jamie had been born, but he recalled enough of the history of his reign to guess what must have happened next. "Only later he put the Bracken girl aside and took up with a Blackwood. Was that the way of it?"
"Lady Melissa," Hoster confirmed. "Missy, they called her. There's a statue of her in our guardswood. She was much more beautiful than Barbara Bracken, but slender, and Barbara was heard to say that Missy was flat as a boy. When King Aegon heard, he gave her Barbara's teats," Jamie laughed. "How did all that begin, between Blackwood and Bracken? Is it written down?"
"It is, my lord," the boy said, "but some of the histories were penned by their maesters and some by ours, centuries after the events that they purport to chronicle. It goes back to the Age of Heroes. The Blackwoods were kings in those days. The Brackens were petty lords, renowned for breeding horses. Rather than pay their king his just due, they used the gold their horses brought them to hire swords and cast him down."
"And when did all this happen?"
500 years before the Andals. 1,000, if the true history is to be believed. Only no one knows when the Andals crossed the Narrow Sea. The true history says 4,000 years have passed since then.
but some maesters claim that it was only two. Past a certain point, all the dates grow hazy and confused, and the clarity of history becomes the fog of legend.
Tyrion would like this one. They could talk from dusk to dawn, arguing about books. For a moment his bitterness towards his brother was forgotten, until he remembered what the imp had done.
"So you are fighting over a crown that one of you took from the other, back when the Casterlys still held Casterly Rock. Is that the root of it? The crown of a kingdom that has not existed for thousands of years," he chuckled. "So many years, so many wars, so many kings. You'd think someone would have made a peace?"
"Someone did, my lord. Many someones. We've had 100 pieces with the Brackens. Many sealed with marriages. There's Blackwood blood in every Bracken, and Bracken blood in every Blackwood. The old king's peace lasted half a century, but then some fresh quarrel broke out, and the old wounds opened and began to bleed again. That's how it always happens, my father says. So long as men remember the wrongs done to their forebears, no peace will ever last. So we go on century after century, with us hating the Brackens and them hating us. My father says there will never be an end to it."
"There could be."
"How, my lord? The old wounds never heal, my father says."
"My father had a saying, too. Never wound a foe when you can kill him. Dead men don't claim vengeance."
"Their sons do," said Hoster, apologetically.
"Not if you kill the sons as well. Ask the Casterlys about that, if you doubt me. Ask Lord and Lady Tarbeck, or the Reigns of Castamere. Ask the Prince of Dragonstone." For an instant, the deep red clouds that crowned the western hills reminded him of Rhaegar's children, all wrapped up in crimson cloaks.
"Is that why you killed all the Starks?"
"Not all," said Jaime. "Lord Eddard's daughters live. One has just been wed. The other... Brienne, where are you? Have you found her? If the gods are good, she'll forget she was a Stark. She'll wed some burly blacksmith or fat-faced innkeep, fill his house with children, and never need to fear that some knight might come along to smash their heads against a wall."
"The gods are good," his hostage said, uncertainly.
"You go on believing that." Jaime let Honor feel his spurs. Pennytree proved to be a much larger village than he had anticipated. The war had been here, too. Blackened orchards and the scorched shells of broken houses testified to that. But for every home in ruins, three more had been rebuilt. Through the gathering blue dusk, Jaime glimpsed fresh thatch upon a score of roofs, and doors made of raw green wood. Between a duck pond and a blacksmith's forge, he came upon the tree that gave the place its name, an oak, ancient and tall, its gnarled roots twisted in and out of the earth like a nest of slow brown serpents, and hundreds of old copper pennies that had been nailed to its huge trunk. Peck stared at the tree, and then at the empty houses.
"Where are the people?"
"Hiding," Jaime told him. Inside the homes, all the fires had been put out, but some still smoked, and none of them were cold. The nanny goat that Hot Harry Morell had found rooting through a vegetable garden was the only living creature to be seen. But the village had a holdfast as strong as any in the Riverlands, with thick stone walls 12 feet high, and Jaime knew that was where he'd find the villagers.
"They hid behind those walls when raiders came, and that's why there's still a village here, and they are hiding there again, from me."
He rode Honor up to the holdfast gates. "You in the holdfast! We mean you no harm. We're king's men." Faces appeared on the wall above the gate. They were king's men, burned our village, one man called down. Before that, some other king's men took our sheep. They were for a different king, but that didn't matter none to our sheep. King's men killed Harsley and Sir Ormond, and raped Lacey till she died.
Not my men, Jamie said. Will you open your gates?
When you're gone, we will.
Sir Kenneth rode close to him. We could break that gate down easy enough, or put it to the torch. Well, they dropped stones on us, and feather us with arrows. Jamie shook his head. It would be a bloody business, and for what? These people have done us no harm. We'll shelter in their houses, but I'll have no stealing. We have our own provisions. As a half-moon crept up the sky, they staked their horses out in the village commons, and supped on salted mutton, dried apples, and hard cheese. Jamie ate sparingly, and shared a skin of wine with Peck and Huss, the hostage. He tried to count the pennies nailed to the old oak, but there were too many of them, and he kept losing count.
What's that all about?
The Blackwood boy would tell him if he asked, but that would spoil the mystery. He had posted sentries to see that no one left the confines of the village. He sent out scouts as well, to make certain no enemy took them unawares. It was near midnight when two came riding back with a woman they had taken captive. She rode up, bold as you please, my lord, demanding words with you. Jamie scrambled to his feet. My lady, I had not thought to see you again so soon.
God's be good, she looks 10 years older than when I saw her last. And what's happened to her face?
That bandage. You've been wounded?
A bite.
She touched the hilt of her sword, the sword that he had given her. Oath keeper.
My lord, you gave me a quest.
The girl.
Have you found her?
I have, said Brian, maid of Tarth.
Where is she?
A day's ride. I can take you to her, sir, but you will need to come alone. Elsewise, the hound will kill her.
John.
Rillo, sang Melisandre, her arms upraised against the falling snow. You are the light in our eyes, the fire in our hearts, the heat in our loins. Yours is the sun that warms our days, yours the stars that guard us in the dark of night. All praise Relore, the Lord of Light. The wedding guests answered in ragged chorus before a gust of ice-cold wind blew their words away. John Snow raised the hood of his cloak. The snowfall was light today, a thin scattering of flakes dancing in the air. But the wind was blowing from the east along the wall, cold as the breath of the ice dragon in the tales old Nan used to tell. Even Melisandre's fire was shivering. The flames huddled down in the ditch, crackling softly as the red priestess sang. Only ghosts seemed not to feel the chill. Addis Carstock leaned close to John.
Snow during a wedding means a cold marriage. My lady mother always said so.
He glanced at Queen Selyse. There must have been a blizzard the day she and Stannis wed. Huddled beneath her ermine mantle and surrounded by her ladies, serving girls and knights, the Southron queen seemed a frail, pale, shrunken thing. A strained smile was frozen into place on her thin lips, but her eyes brimmed with reverence. She hates the cold, but loves the flames. He had only to look at her to see that. A word from Melisandre, and she would walk into the fire willingly, embrace it like a lover. Not all her queen's men seemed to share her fervour. Sir Brass appeared half-drunk. Sir Malagorn's gloved hand was cupped round the arse of the lady beside him. Sir Narbot was yawning and Sir Patrick of King's Mountain looked angry. John Snow had begun to understand why Stannis had left them with his queen. "The night is dark and filled with terrors," Melisandre sang. "Alone we are born, and alone we die. But as we walk through this black veil, we draw strength from one another, and from you, our lord." Her scarlet silks and satins swirled with every gust of wind. "Two come forth today to join their lives, so they may face this world's darkness together. Fill their hearts with fire, my lord, so they may walk your shining path hand in hand forever."
"Lord of light, protect us," cried Queen Selyse.
Other voices echoed the response. Melisandre's faithful, pallid ladies, shivering serving girls, Sir Axel and Sir Narbot and Sir Lambert, men-at-arms in iron mail and fens in bronze, even a few of John's black brothers.
"Lord of light, bless your children."
Melisandre's back was to the wall on one side of the deep ditch where her fire burned. The couple to be joined faced her across the ditch. Behind them stood the queen, with her daughter and her tattooed fool. Princess Shireen was wrapped in so many furs that she looked round, breathing in white puffs through the scarf that covered most of her face. Sir Axel Florent and his queen's men surrounded the royal party, with a tall bravassi banker looming over all of them. Though only a few men of the Night's Watch had gathered about the ditch fire, more looked down from rooftops and windows and the steps of the great switchback stair. John took careful note of who was there and who was not. Some men had the duty, many just off watch were fast asleep, but others had chosen to absent themselves to show their disapproval. Athel Yarvik and Bowen Marsh were amongst the missing. Septon Shale had emerged briefly from the sept, fingering the seven-sided crystal on the thong about his neck, only to retreat inside again once the prayers began. Melisandre raised her hands, and the ditch fire leapt upwards towards her fingers, like a great red dog springing for a treat. A swirl of sparks rose to meet the snowflakes coming down. "O Lord of Light, we thank you," she sang to the hungry flames. "We thank you for brave Stannis, by your grace our king. Guide him and defend him, R'hllor. Protect him from the treacheries of evil men, and grant him strength to smite the servants of the dark."
"Grant him strength," answered Queen Selyse and her knights and ladies. "Grant him courage. Grant him wisdom."
Alice Carstark slipped her arm through John's. "How much longer, Lord Snow? If I'm to be buried beneath this snow, I'd like to die a woman wed." "Soon, my lady," John assured her, "soon."
"We thank you for the sun that warms us," chanted the queen. "We thank you for the stars that watch over us in the black of night. We thank you for our hearths and for our torches, which keep the savage dark at bay. We thank you for our bright spirits, the fires in our loins and in our hearts."
And Melisandre said, "Let them come forth who would be joined." The flames cast her shadow on the wall behind her, and her ruby gleamed against the paleness of her throat. John turned to Alice Carstark. "My lady, are you ready?"
"Yes, oh yes."
"You're not scared?" The girl smiled in a way that reminded John so much of his little sister that it almost broke his heart.
"Let him be scared of me."
The snowflakes were melting on her cheeks, but her hair was wrapped in a swirl of lace that Saturn had found somewhere, and the snow had begun to collect there, giving her a frosty crown. Her cheeks were flushed and red, and her eyes sparkled. Winter's lady. John squeezed her hand. The Magnar of Thin stood waiting by the fire, clad as if for battle,